Hi, everybody, and welcome to Mecha Dragon, a podcast about all the geeky and nerdy stuff you love. But mostly movies, at least for now. Brought to you by Captain Geek and the Dark Nerd. I'm your Captain, Will.
And I'm your nerd, Jess.
Today, we're talking about the 1982 movie The Dark Crystal. One of my personal favorites, and probably one of the most influential movies of my young life, just in terms of how it sparked my imagination and got me interested in creative endeavors. So we are revisiting The Dark Crystal today because, as some of you may know, on August 30th this year, 2019, Netflix is releasing the first season of a Dark Crystal prequel show called Dark Crystal Age of Resistance. And wow, it looks pretty cool. So we thought we would revisit the original movie and talk about it today. Jess, why don't you start by giving us your general impressions of The Dark Crystal?
Oh, boy. Well, Dark Crystal came out in 82 when I was 4 years old. And us early 80s kids basically were in the era of Jim Henson. You know, that's when he was at his full power. And we had the Muppets and all that stuff and Fraggle Rock and this and that. And watching it again, like we just watched it recently, it's incredible the amount of detail and stuff they put into it. And it has influenced, you can see, so many things throughout the years. And it's just a fantastic thing. And I always think back on it as a classic because I've seen it so many times growing up and I've shared it with my kids. And it's a ride, that's for sure.
Yeah. Can you talk just a little about, like, how it struck you when you first saw it as a kid, if you can even remember the first time you saw it, and what it was like, you know, watching it now, and you know, was there any difference, or what was the same in terms of your, you know, experience of the movie and your reaction to it?
Honestly, I think the first time I saw it, I was probably, I don't know, 7 or 8, and I'm sure I look at it through a different prism now, but then it was just, you know, like they mention, it's the age of wonder, and that's something I couldn't really ignore growing up. It was just something that just captivated the attention, and it was just so fantastic, and the sets and everything, it was great. It's hard to really describe.
For me, I don't know that I could remember, like, the, you know, exact circumstances of when I first watched it as a kid, but what I do remember is just being absolutely blown away by it. I mean, they have created this fantastical world from the ground up, right, in a very real way. I mean, every little detail in there, like, somebody created out of their imagination. It's one of
It's almost like the level of detail. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it's one of those movies that so many details of it have stuck in my memory through all the years since I've watched it. I mean, it came out in 1982. I don't think I actually saw it in 1982 because I would have been like 4 years old at the time or something. So I feel like the first time I watched it was probably on HBO or something. When I was a kid, you know, maybe like you said, like 7 or 8 years old or something. But so many details just always stuck out to me, you know, that the singing of the mystics, the wine of the Chamberlain, the look of the Dark Crystal, the, you know, that scene where the podling is being drained of his vital essence, like those images and more, many more, stuck in my mind throughout all the years. And that's one of those movies, like, you know, when I became an adult, I bought it on DVD. Later, when there's a Blu-ray edition, I bought it on Blu-ray, like, at least once. You know?
Right.
Like that, I might actually...
Gotta keep it in the library.
Yeah, seriously. And, you know, it's one of those ones where I always thought, because, you know, I've always wanted to have kids, and now that I do, I've always wanted to show them and share this, like, amazing experience that I had when I was a kid, and I'm really looking forward to that with my son. I mean, he's only, like, he's not even 3 years old yet, so it's gonna be a while.
You got a while.
And here's the difference with watching it today, because I had, before, you know, a couple days ago, I haven't seen this movie in at least 10 years, or about 10 years, because I think I watched it,
right,
like, after I picked it up on DVD or something, like, 10 years ago. But before that, I'm sure I hadn't seen it since I was a kid, you know. I mean, maybe I watched it with, like, a group of people in college when we were all, you know, drinking or something, but I don't remember that.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the background. I'm the same way. It's like you really didn't focus on it, and we just watched it yesterday, my son and I. And
how old's your
when
son?
When you sit down and get into it, it sucks you in.
It
it's
does.
Crazy.
And how old's your 10. Son? He's 10? Okay. Well, you know, I've been thinking, yeah, what's the appropriate age to introduce it to kids? And this might be a question that, you know, if you're listening to this podcast. And you, right. but, like, if you're listening to this podcast and you have kids and you're thinking, oh, yeah, I'd love to watch that with my, you know, my son or my daughter, what's the appropriate age? Because, man, when I was watching it a couple days ago, I'm like, whoa, there are lots of really dark, like, kind of scary, macabre parts of this movie. But, you know, right, I was doing just a little bit of research on it, and Jim Henson believed that it was actually a good thing to scare children sometimes. I mean, not in terms of, like, hurting them, you know, in real life, but, like, if they're watching a movie or some, you know, listening to a story or something, it's actually good to do that because we don't want to coddle them too much. And right, in a sense, you know, exposing them to these darker aspects in storytelling can kind of, you know, make the real world a little bit less oppressive. And that seemed to be his philosophy behind it.
Yeah, and that's exactly true, because children need to learn at a young age that there are plenty of things in this world that will suck your life essence right out of you. Just like in the movie.
Yeah, and I also think, and we'll get into this when we talk in more detail, but I think that the movie has a really good message for kids. I mean, it's not like, you know, everybody that's listening to this probably has seen this movie. If you haven't, you know, that's fine. I will say, spoiler alert, though. I mean, I don't know if that's necessary for a movie that was made in 1982 at this point, but we are going to talk in depth about, you know, what happens in this movie, and there will be spoilers, I'm certain. So just FYI. But
yeah. Yeah, spoiler alert, 35 years later.
Right.
40 years, whatever. I don't know.
So before we get into the meat of this conversation, I just want to give us a quick recap of the movie, which, you know, can refresh everybody's memory if you haven't seen it in a really long time. And, you know, if you're listening to this for a review before you check it out for the first time, for whatever reason, it'll, you know, give you some context for everything that we're going to be talking about. Here we go. For 1,000 years, the evil Skeksis have ruled the land from the Castle of the Crystal, while, far away, the gentle mystics have lived in peace. Both ancient races are dying, with only 10 of each left alive. Jen is a young Gelfling whose family and clan were killed by the Skeksis, and so he was taken in by the mystics and raised by the wisest of them. In the final moments before his teacher and adoptive father's death, Jen learns he is at the center of a prophecy to prevent the Skeksis from ruling forever. He must find Crystal Shard at the home of Algra, grief-stricken and confused, but intent on honoring his adoptive father's final request. Jen leaves the Valley of the Mystics and follows the Greater Sun toward Algra's home. Back at the castle, the Skeksis gather around the Dark Crystal in a ritual that converts light from one of the three suns into life-sustaining energy. Afterward, the death of their bedridden emperor prompts a duel between the brutish general and the whimpering Chamberlain to decide who will become the Skeksis' next leader. When the general wins, Chamberlain is stripped of his robes and exiled. In that moment, the Dark Crystal calls the Skeksis into its chamber and shows them Jen. Horrified, they shriek about how the prophecy says a Gelfling will destroy them. The new emperor commands large beetle-like monsters, called Garthim, to capture the Gelfling and bring him to the castle, where they will kill him. Meanwhile, the mystics gathered mourn the passing of their wisest and then set off on a journey of their own. Algra finds Jen searching along the mountainside, and surprised to find a Gelfling, she takes him into her home, where a huge mechanism called an orrery helps her predict the movements of the suns and other bodies in the sky. She explains that soon the three suns will come together to cause the Great Conjunction, which will be either the end of the world or a new beginning. She has a box full of crystal shards, but doesn't know which is the one Jen needs. Using a bit of the musical magic he learned from the mystics, Jen identifies the correct shard. But before Algra can tell him what he must do with it, the Garthim break in and attack. Jen manages to escape out a window while the Garthim stuff Algra into a sack and tear apart her home. In the distance, Jen sees Algra's house burn. He sets off through the forest where he meets a female Gelfling, Kira, and her friendly little pet monster, Fizgig. With their hands touch, they share each other's memories, both of which show how the Skeksis killed their families before they were raised by others. Kira was raised by the earthy Podlings, who gave her a happy childhood. She also has the power to talk to animals and plants. Although Jen doesn't know how to continue with his quest, they're excited that neither of them is the last Gelfling as they once believed. Back at the castle, the Skeksis are surprised when Algra tumbles out of the Garthim sack. She reminds them of the prophecy which prompts the Skeksis to send a swarm of crystal bats to find Jen. Kira spots one of these bats while they travel down a river and knocks it out of the sky, but it sees them anyway. Kira introduces Jen to her podling clan during a festive gathering, and Jen even gets into the spirit by playing his flute along with the band. But when the Garthim attack, the Gelflings flee for their lives. They run deep into the forest before finally collapsing in exhaustion. When they awake, they find a long-abandoned Gelfling building with an inscription of the prophecy inside. It's here they learn what to do next: heal the dark crystal by reinserting the shard to make it whole once more. Suddenly, the Chamberlain Skeksis arrives and tries to convince Jen to come with him to the castle, to convince the others he means them no harm. Supposedly, so the Skeksis will stop trying to kill the Gelflings. But Jen sees through the deception and flees with Kira. She calls the Land Striders gentle, long-legged beasts, which provide speedy transport to the castle. As they approach the castle, they see the Garthim, who attacked earlier, carrying their podling captives towards Skeksis enslavement. Jen and Kira charge with the Land Striders and free the podlings, but are cornered when the Land Striders go down. Kira pulls Jen off of a cliff, and wings extend from her back, allowing them to land safely in the rocky gorge below. Chamberlain watches as they enter the castle bowels through a drainage tunnel. In the tunnels beneath the castle, Chamberlain catches up to the Gelflings and grabs them. Jen strikes the Skeksis with the shard, drawing blood. We see that one of the mystics' hands begins to bleed, another clue that the mystics and Skeksis are connected in some way. Chamberlain causes a collapse in the tunnel, burying Jen, and regains his place among the other Skeksis by delivering Kira to them. Most want to kill her right away, but the Emperor demands that she be drained of her vital essence first, which will make him more youthful. Scientist straps her into the collection chair. When the crystal's magic begins to drain her, she sings to the caged animals in the lab, who then break free, push the scientist into the lava beneath the crystal, and release Kira. In the moment scientist dies, one of the traveling mystics evaporates in a puff of smoke. Jen climbs out of the tunnel debris and runs from several Garthim. He escapes through a hole in the wall, which leads to the volcanic shaft over which the dark crystal is suspended. As he climbs, Algra, also caged in the lab, tells Kira the Great Conjunction is at hand. The mystics arrive at the castle entrance, turning aside the Garthim sentries with their magic. Jen climbs out of the shaft, but hides when the Skeksis gather at the crystal to watch the three suns converging in the sky. When the light from all three bathes the crystal at once, its magic will allow them to live forever. Face pale, Kira runs into the crystal chamber where the Skeksis attack her. Jen leaps onto the dark crystal but drops the shard. As the Skeksis close in on her, Kira grabs the shard and throws it to Jen. The Skeksis kill her. A beam of triple sunlight strikes the crystal as Jen slams the shard into place and the castle shakes. Rock and mortar crumbles from the walls, revealing a white surface beneath. The Skeksis try to flee, but the mystics have finally arrived. The power of the healed crystal pulls them toward each other and ultimately fuses each mystic with its corresponding Skeksis. In their place stand eight luminous beings who explain that in their arrogance and delusion, they split the crystal long ago, which split themselves and the world, but they're now one again. They tell Jen to hold Kira, that she is part of him because we are all part of each other. Jen cradles Kira in his arms, and she awakens. Together, they watch the angelic beings transform into pure energy and ascend to the sky. The crystal glows white with the power of truth. Outside, the once barren landscape is now green and teeming with life, with a gleaming white castle at the center. The end.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So that was a little bit longer of a read. There is a lot going on in there. I mean, I think the reason that this recap that I wrote is so long is because it's not like maybe a standard, you know, blockbuster movie that you'd see over the summer these days, where things begin, the hero gets a clear-cut goal, and you know, maybe there's some twists and turns, but you know, it's in a recognizable world
where the crystal cracked.
Right. Well, it's in most movies now are in. I don't want to say most movies, but when a movie is in a recognizable world, you don't have to explain that much. You just say the hero did this, this, and he encountered a couple problems and right. He overcame them this way. But like in this one, not a lot makes sense unless, you know, you have some background. And anyway, I don't need to explain my recap.
Jen was late for work one day and had no idea what the world had in store.
So now that we've gone through that, recap. So why don't we just talk about some highlights of this movie? So what were some of the really standout moments for you that, you know, were the most memorable or hit you the hardest?
One of the things I always think about when I think of Dark Crystal, I always remember is the Mystics and their singing. You know, that real deep, oh, and that is just hearing that and seeing that scene always gets me all excited. And I was actually watching this, and it reminded me of a lot of different things. It almost seems like this movie was slightly influenced by Star Wars at times, you know? It's like when the old Mystic dies, and he's under his blanket in his little hovel or whatever. And then he fades away, just like Yoda does when he dies. And then at one point, Jen's trying to escape. After he meets Agra and the Garthan attack, he like escapes and falls down this ravine, and he's in this little valley thing where it's swampy and there's vines and stuff hanging down. And that part kind of reminded me of Dagobah.
Interesting.
Young Skywalker is with Yoda there doing his training, and then Kira comes along and like summons up the big worm maggot thing from the swamp, not unlike an X-Wing fighter. But I was just watching this, and I just keep seeing stuff like that.
Those are interesting parallels, but I don't think those are really like, oh, I'm going to do these things that Star Wars did. I think it's just
I understand that. It's just, yeah, I'm sure it is. But the amount of detail in the sets and the costumes and stuff.
Oh my God, the level of detail.
Incredible.
Like, there's literally, like, there'll be, like, when they're passing through the swamp or down the river or whatever it is, like, literally there will be, like, little animals that, you know, the design team made and were constructed for the movie. And you barely even see them. They're just, like, sort of, like, moving back and forth between the reeds, like, behind the reeds over there. And, like, you don't even get a good look at it. You know, but still, yeah,
part of the
made
atmosphere.
Like they made that whole like detailed puppet just for that one shot where like you barely see it. Like stuff like that is just amazing.
Yeah, and you see like the plants. You see the plants breathing.
Right,
you know,
right.
There's just so much stuff, and it was so funny because when I put it on, we're about 5 minutes into it, and my son's like, "Wait, this movie came out when you were young?" I was like, "Yeah, it came out when I was 4." He's like, "How come the graphics are so good?" <You know? laughs> And that's it too. I mean, because there's just, I mean, the set design and the detail is something you'd expect to find today in just Jim Henson's workshop.
Well, I think it's definitely a level of detail that you would expect to find today. Although I don't see any, I mean, aside from the new Netflix Dark Crystal prequel show, right? I don't.
Yeah. Well, now everything's CGI.
Nobody does puppets to this scale anymore. I mean, I don't know anything that was on the same level as Dark Crystal, you know, in terms of using puppets for everything and creating a whole world from the ground up, you know, and all of that.
The only thing would be the Muppets, and they're just on an actual set, you know, being controlled by people, you know.
Obviously, that's Henson too, but, you know, it's just not to the same epic scale of it all and everything. So right. Here's the other thing about The Dark Crystal. One of the things that I find fascinating about it. So when I was watching it, you know, just a couple days ago in preparation for this podcast, there's definitely a big part of it for me that's very nostalgic. Like there's definitely this great feeling of nostalgia when I'm watching it. But at the same time, it still made me feel totally separate from the nostalgia to the extent that, you know, I can separate nostalgia from this movie that I loved for so many years ago. But aside from the nostalgia, it still was really able to excite my imagination and make me feel that wonder and just suck me into the world of the story and just let me sort of inhabit it. This is something that this movie does better than any other of my cherished, you know, childhood movies that I can remember because, I mean, with the exception of maybe Star Wars, because I can still watch A New Hope and be like, you know, really into it. And I just love that movie. But for a lot of movies that I saw when I was a kid revisiting them, you know, there's definitely the nostalgia factor, but it doesn't necessarily reawaken that sense of, you know, awe and wonder in me as it once did, because, you know, now I'm a crusty old man with a, you know, a heart of black stone. And, you know, all these things that time does to you as you get older, that it can do to you, where you become, you know, more cynical and jaded, or just not even necessarily that, but just more hardened and, you know, used to the harsh realities of the world. But this is one of the few movies I can still look back on and like still have that experience of childlike wonder watching it. And to me, that's one of the most valuable things, because it really gives me, it allows me to expand my perspective a little bit and just, that's what it does.
I like it. Well, yeah, it's like we all have, you know, movies when we're growing up and we love them, and much to the chagrin of our parents, we watch them 40 times a year or 40 times a month, perhaps. And then, you know, 20, 30 years later, like, oh, what about that one movie? I got to see that again. That was my favorite as a kid. And you go to watch it and you're like, wow, this is crap. You know? Yeah. And it's like, I was stupid when I was 7. But you don't get that with The Dark Crystal. I mean, just the scope of, and the story, like you said, that childlike wonder, there's a lot to look at and a lot to see, and that sucks you in. But there's also the story, the adventure, the writing. You know, it's not like the acting is fantastic in this as far as the
puppet. I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know any of the actors. But aside from Yoda, what's his face?
Frank Oz.
Frank Oz. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who co-directed it with Jim Henson, by the way.
Correct. Yeah, it's just like this movie does stand up 20, 30 years later, and it still does suck you in, and it's still enjoyable.
I think one of the reasons is that even though clearly a big part of the intended audience for this movie are children, it doesn't condescend. It respects the intellect of a child, without talking down to them. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, all kids are like, you should just send them to MIT when they're like 8 years old. You know, I'm just saying that there's a lot of kids shows that, you know, practically like just baby talk to them.
Right.
And I hate those shows. I mean, maybe, you know, they can be valuable entertainment for a kid at a certain point in their development, like the Teletubbies, which I actually find to be frightening, but they don't say words. They're just like,
right.
And I saw like a black and white picture, like a screenshot from the Teletubbies once, and it was like one of the most frightening things I've ever seen. They just look like monsters.
This is the things nightmares are made of.
Yeah. But anyways, I think that one of the reasons this movie has such staying power and that it still stands as like a really strong story is because it doesn't like censor itself or try to shield, you know, the children from the darker aspects of what would be in a fantasy story like this. Because, you know, like we mentioned, there's some dark stuff in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and you don't really pick up on that stuff, you know, as a child watching it. It's kind of like when, you know, as a parent, Well, actually, I wasn't apparent when it started, but when Pixar started coming out with the Toy Stories and the Finding Nemos, you know, and you start watching those as an adult, you see there's so many different layers of humor and storylines going on. Like, some are for the kids and some are for the adults. And the kids aren't going to get this layer until, sure, you know, they're, mm-hmm, older. And it's kind of the same way with the Dark Crystal. I mean, there's just the story itself. Like you said, it doesn't pander to the children, and it's definitely got something for the adults as well. And if any of you have never seen this, definitely check it out. And if you have seen it, but it was been 10, 20, 30 years ago, you need to rewatch this movie.
So your comparison to Toy Story, I would make a distinction between how Toy Story interweaves the stuff for the adults and the stuff for the kids with the way that it is for the Dark Crystal. So, like you mentioned with like the Toy Story and like a lot of the Pixar movies, you know, there will be these references that like an adult would get, but a kid wouldn't, or like a joke that will fly over the head of a kid, right? But like, you know, as a parent or an adult, like you can enjoy that, and maybe the kids will laugh at it, but for a totally different reason because they're, you know, not seeing it from the same angle. With the Dark Crystal, I think that it appeals to both kids and adults more because the story is just incredibly strong, because, you know, the Dark Crystal is not a jokey
not at all.
You know, movie, and it doesn't really, I mean, there's really no references to anything from real modern day life because it's set in a totally separate fantasy world with its own rules and everything. And so I feel like
it's enjoyable though too, because it's a classic, you know, good versus evil.
Well, yes. Although I think the theme of the movie, the ultimate, you know, message of the movie kind of transcends the whole good versus evil thing. But we can get to that.
Okay, let's talk about some of the costumes and stuff.
So the costumes in terms of what the characters wore, or do you just want to talk more about?
Oh, just more the visual look, like the
whole Skeksis design of it. Yeah, character design.
Yeah, the Skeksis are crazy, and I like how they worked in. Yeah, I've been practicing that. We watched the movie yesterday, and then we watched all the trailers for the new Netflix series coming out. And at the end of the trailers, they keep putting in his little
whine. I love that.
Whatever it's called. And God, I hate your whining.
That one sound cue, his whine. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it very well, but that one sound cue, his whining, is like, that sound has stayed with me through my entire life ever since the very first time I saw that movie. And like, I'm the kind of guy who like will occasionally like throw out a movie quote, you know, into conversation, or like, I'd love to, you know, this is the, you know, the geek in me is like, I'll constantly make references because I've always been like a film nerd. You know, I also happen to be a geek and all these other things, but like occasionally I'll just go, you know, I can't do it right now, but
I can never do it.
And even, you know, when I don't say it, sometimes, I don't know, it's just always in the back of my mind there. Somehow.
Yeah, and my son was listening to it and he's like, oh, I can't stand that. Is he going to do that every single time he's on screen? And I was like, yes, that's how you know who he is. And,
yeah, I mean,
they were playing that at the end of the trailers. He was like, oh my God.
I mean, they did such a great job of making all of the characters distinct.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, any movie that's made is such a collaborative process, but I think this movie more than others, because when you're talking about the characters, okay, you have the voice actor, you have I was gonna say puppeteers, but I think that's not quite the right word. I mean, they're performers,
puppet masters.
They're the performers of those puppets and those rigs, right? And so you have those two, you know, and then you have the people that created the puppets, you know, and then you have the people that designed the puppets. So it's just like all of that comes together, and you get the Chamberlain looking the way that he looks with the movement of the head that he has, you know, with that voice, with that whine, and it just all comes together and, you know, just blows you away.
Yeah. And speaking of the puppet creators, I can't remember the last name. I think it's like Straup or Stroud or something like that, or Stroop. The guy that created, you know, most of the visual effects for the puppets and stuff in this movie. I'm not sure if he's still alive. He might be. But his wife and son are also carrying on in the tradition, and they're working on the, they're in the same role for the new Netflix thing. So you're going to have a lot of the same, exact same influence and look to it, and that's cool.
So you're talking about Brian Froud, or Brian Froud.
Froud, yeah.
And yes, it's him and his wife and his son. And his son, by the way, his son was the baby in Labyrinth.
Right.
Yeah. And now he's working, you know.
He got to meet Bowie.
Yeah, and now he's working alongside his parents on this new Dark Crystal show. And, you know, this is one of those things that now that I'm a parent, I can look at it and there's just a whole new level of meaning. Because, like, I was watching a lot of the, like, trailers and things for the new Dark Crystal show, too. And there was just this shot of, you know, the son working on, like, one of the, you know, one of the puppets. And his father mm-hmm. in the background just like watching, and I'm like, oh my God, his father must just be like so incredibly proud that he's like gonna burst.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, he's probably got some like set pieces or, you know, things from the original Dark Crystal that they have on display in the house, and his son grew up, you know, doing that. And of course he was a movie star in Labyrinth, which yeah. is another fantastic movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, it would be cool to have that carried on some 40 years later and have his son actually have the same drive and motivation. That would be incredibly pleasing to a parent.
Yeah. So,
and speaking of incredibly pleasing, the Gartham,
mm-hmm.
those crab monsters,
mm-hmm.
those are terrifying. Those are one of the most terrifying images from that movie, you know, that I remember as a child. It's like those big shambling hulking with all their little tentacles and their big claws. Those were cool designs.
You know, the thing is, when I was a kid watching this movie, and I imagine that it was similar for you, but when I was a kid watching this movie, you know, there were parts of this movie that scared me.
Yeah.
You know, that were scary, but at the same time, the whole movie just thrilled me. You know, it excited me, and it was just a great, really satisfying story. So
mm-hmm.
there are movies that have scary things in them, or maybe they glorify violence in a certain way nowadays that, you know, I wouldn't want my son to see until he's like 13 or 14 or something like that, right? If it's like a PG-13 right. movie. On the other hand, you know, this movie, if it was released now, maybe it would be PG-13 because of the, you know, there's some violence in it, and there's some, there's death, and there's, you know, there's the Emperor Skeksis at the beginning. He like decomposes right before your eyes.
He gets dusted. It's a snapping. Know? I mean, Thanos's reach is far.
And they, yeah. And they enslave these podlings, and like that scene where they're sucking out the life essence of that one is just kind of gruesome. So I have to imagine that.
And their eyes glaze over. Yeah. And they get all sunken cheeks.
So that's I wonder if that movie would be PG-13 nowadays, but that's a movie where I would actually show it to my son when he's like maybe like 8 years old, because it doesn't glorify the violence, and it's, you know, I'm willing to go along with Jim Henson's philosophy of like, it's okay to, you know, show kids scary things every now and then, because if you just shelter them their whole lives or until they're teenagers or something, you know, then they're not going to be as prepared to face the world. And I believe that. Anyway, let's get into some more detail on this movie. So I want to talk about a part of this movie that hit me really hard. So let's talk about the theme of this movie, which, you know, you get the clearest. Jesus Christ, I can't even fucking talk today. Let me take a drink. Let me take a sip.
Okay.
Wow, yeah, these morning podcasts are rough.
Holy fuck.
Mm. Okay, so
my son, when they were talking to the little Fizzgig,
mm-hmm.
and he's funny every time he fucking is on screen. He goes, his mouth opens real big. My mm-hmm. son's like, what's his name? Is it Biscuit? So of course now I have to call him Biscuit forever.
Right, right. Yeah. So wait, so this was your son's first time seeing this movie, right?
I think, yeah. Yeah, actually it is. Yeah, because we were talking about it like a week or two ago, and he's like, what's Dark Crystal? And I was like, me and my daughter looked at each other, then looked at him, you've never seen it? So, yeah, this is his first watch.
Can you give us a quick rundown of how he reacted to the movie? Because, you know, one of the greatest things is watching how children react to something that's totally new to them. You know, especially, you know, it's really, I think it's really true when people say, you know, you can see the world anew through a children's eyes, like your own children.
Right, exactly. You
know? So what was his experience?
Yeah, that's why I love watching stuff with my kids, because I get, you know, enjoyment from their enjoyment and their reactions and stuff. And I think it's different with us in 1984 or 1987, whenever it was we watched this film, because we didn't have all the summer blockbusters and the Avengers and Tony Stark and all the other Pixar and stuff like
that.
Not
to mention, how rare was it that Hollywood made a fantasy movie?
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And, I mean, it was Dark Crystal and Neverending Story. That was about it.
Well, there's a few other ones like Krull and Beastmaster. Like, there is, you know, sometimes things like that. But usually, almost always, they were super low budget, kind of cheesy, which made things like The Dark Crystal really stand out.
Yeah. And watching it with him, like I said, he was 5 minutes in. And he's like, wait, this is an old movie. How come the graphics are so good? And he made a couple comments throughout it, like when the birds are flying through the sky and, you know, they had the old CGI from 1982, which is terrible
that,
by
today's
standards.
I mean, that
standards.
Wasn't even CGI. I mean, those were optical visual effects, but right. Yeah.
Yeah. But overall, he said at the end, he's like, I was like, how was it? He's like, it was all right. You know, it was all right. But
was he being like purposefully like blasé about it and like trying to hide the fact that he liked it, or was it?
He's mostly low-key in his day-to-day life. But yeah, I think he liked it. And there was just a lot of stuff where, like when they're sucking the life essence out of the podlings, he's like, what am I watching? You know? But yeah, and that's the thing. That's because those scenes do still get you, you know. No matter when the movie's made, it's still something that you really can't block out.
And that scene that you mentioned, too, where they're sucking the life out of the podling, it's like, that scene is so vivid because, like, literally, I don't know how they did this with the puppets, but, like, literally you watch, like, his face, like, contract and get paler, you know, and, like, when
his eyes glaze over.
Yeah, that was amazing. Okay, yeah. So I did want to talk about the theme of this movie a bit, and you really get the biggest, you know, the most explicit like comments about it in the film at the end when they you know, put the crystal back together and the Skeksis and the Mystics merge into those Urskeks or whatever they're called, those angelic luminous beings, and you know it says I think I read that they're called Urskeks. Actually, let me see. I have it here. Yeah, the Urskeks, because they're another name for the Mystics are the Uru, which is something I saw in one of the little featurettes about the new Netflix show. But at the end, they say, you know, they tell Jen to hold Kira, and they say, because we are all part of each other. And so throughout the movie, you have this concept of duality, right? Because, I mean, even in the opening, like, narration, where it's kind of giving you the background of this world, it really draws this parallel between the Skeksis and the Mystics, right? It's like, there's only 10 left. There's only 10 left of these. There's only 10 left of those. You know, they're each doing their ritual, you know, but it brings no comfort because yada, yada. The Emperor dies at the same time that the wisest Mystic dies, right? And then through the film, you get a little bit more of that. You know, for example, when he cuts the Chamberlain with the shard and then it cuts to the, and then it goes to the
Mystic's hand,
and which is bleeding. Yeah. So, my hand.
Yeah, and I forgot about that part. You know, from the last time I watched it. So the other day I'm watching it. It's like, oh, that's cool. And then, you know, at the end they merge together. And it's like, oh, that was
Yeah,
unforeseen.
And so it's interesting that they're commenting that these beings, in order to be whole, in order to be healthy, in order for the world to be healthy, right?
Yeah.
There's necessarily a balance between, you know, light and dark, between good and evil, if you want to put it that way. Those are halves of a whole. Right? Right. And there's also this comment about sort of the interconnectedness of things because, you know, he says we're all a part of each other. And I just think that that's a really powerful, constructive message that, frankly, is still timely, or perhaps more timely now than it has been in a while. Right.
Yeah.
You know, there just seems to be a lot of increasing polarization in this country and around the world, frankly. And so...
And that's the thing. We need to come together to, you know, find peace and grow and be healthy.
Yeah. And so I really like that part of the message. And, you know, like we were saying, that is seeded through the entire movie. You know, I don't think it's even just with the Skeksis and the mystics. I mean, there's also this concept of all the suns coming together in a great convergence, right? There's also the male and female, right? Because Jen is not quite a complete person, you know, by himself. And there's this whole thing where when he's first leaving the Valley of the Mystics, he has this moment where he says something like, okay, I'm going alone. And then there's this moment that mirrors that later in the movie when he gets onto the Landstriders with Kira, and she and he said something like, well, you don't have to come with me, and she said, I know, and then he goes, okay, together. And from that point on, you know, he's really growing a lot more as a character and as a person. And so I find that really interesting because, you know, the Skeksis are here as this force that is separating things. But I do think that those are the kind of things that are seeded throughout the movie that really sort of add up to this really powerful theme. But at the same time, you know, it's not preachy. It's not like telling you, well, you have to make sure to be balanced in all things, as Thanos would have it. Right?
Right. And that's like you said, this is a very this movie right now is very timely, you know, with that sort of theme. And it's also timeless, you know. It's something that should always, you know, kind of be part of everyday life, you know, working together and working on and understanding the duality of all of us, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think the great thing about, and it just goes to show how powerful this movie is, and frankly I think it is a timeless classic. I mean, that's the type of thing that the marketing will put onto the back of like tons of old movie, you know, the DVD box or whatever for tons of old movies. But I think that in this case it's actually true, because we're talking now about how relevant the themes of this story are for today, right? But this movie was made like 35 years ago or something. I'm not doing the math. Yeah. But I mean, it was made in 1982, and here we are talking about it as being relevant to, you know, the current situation in the world. So I think that just goes to show what a powerful story it is, and the fact that when you make a powerful story that is, you know, constructed effectively, you know, and you're not trying to be hyper allegorical with it, you know, that that it can last, that it can remain powerful story as time moves forward. And that's really what makes something a classic, right? It's like, you know, some movies made a lot of money when they're first released, but then, you know, you look back on it 10, 20 years later, and everybody basically, you know, more or less can agree is like, well, that was a steaming pile of garbage. you know, and I don't, you know, we'll give an example is Transformers. Excuse me.
Oh, better get that checked out.
Yeah. But in any case, I was just this time through, I was really impressed at how well the movie and the story stood the test of time.
Yeah, and at first with the new Netflix show, I was thinking it was going to be a sequel. And then I found out it's a prequel. Mm-hmm. So now I'm even more into watching it because I want to see what led up to this. You know, I want to see how the Skeksis and the Mystics, you know, got split apart, you know, in the beginning. Right. And I'd like to see.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, when I was watching it this time, this was the first time I've watched this movie where I was aware of another installment, you know, of the Dark Crystal coming out.
Right.
Being something that would exist, right? And so I knew it was going to be a prequel when I was watching it. And I had watched, like, the trailers, you know, previous to seeing this movie again. But I didn't have a ton of information about the prequel when I first when I watched this movie a couple days ago, other than it was going to be a prequel. And so this is another thing that was exciting my imagination as I was watching it, because I kept, mm-hmm. I was constantly, well, not constantly, but, you know, every now and then I would see something and have a thought and be like, oh, well, like, how is the prequel going to address this? And this was a part of the movie inspiring my imagination. And so I was thinking things like,
I want to see this origin story. I want to see that origin story, you know?
Well, not necessarily like an origin story, but I would think things like right in the opening, when it's having the opening narration, it says only 10 Skeksis are left. Only 10 Mystics are left. I'm thinking, mm-hmm. okay, how long ago is the prequel and how many Skeksis and Mystics will there have been at that time, right? Will it be 15 left, 20, 100? I don't know, right? So that kind of, I was like thinking about that. I was thinking, how long ago is the prequel going to be? Is it going to be, you know, are we going to get to witness and go through the period of time where the Skeksis are trying to just like totally eradicate all the Gelflings? Like, are we going to witness that attempted genocide, you know?
Yeah, and was it something, you know, how they joined together and they, would you say they become when they're one?
The Ur-Skex.
The Ur-Skex. Yeah. Was there a time, like, in the beginning where the Ur-Skex came down and then there was some sort of cataclysm or something to split them apart? Is that what we're going to see? Like, how far back is this prequel going to go?
Right. And are we, and like, I was also thinking, like, because, you know, Augra has that, like, big box full of crystal shards, which she gives to Jen, and she's basically like, I don't know which one it is, knock yourself out. So, like, are we going to find out how she got the crystal shard and, like, why she has all of these and she doesn't know which one is the actual magic, you know, crystal shard? So, you know, all these things were going through my head. And so I found it to be really interesting that I was able to kind of get into the story and, you know, think about it in that way, merely because of the fact that, like, you know, there's a show coming out that I can actually see soon, which is going to maybe explore some of this stuff. Not that, you know, I didn't think about these things before, but now, like, with this concrete evidence that, like, there's more to actually get into, like, it just was exciting.
Yeah, and it's like the Skeksis are sucking the life essence out of the podlings to basically, you know, they're basically making elixirs of youth and they're working on being immortal. So this could have been thousands and thousands of years.
Well, you know? I mean, they did say that they ruled for 1,000 years and that's when the crystal split. Okay. So it couldn't be farther ago than that, given that there are Skeksis in the show.
So with a new show in 1,000 years, we could have 15 seasons.
Well, I did read something to the effect of one of the teasers or things that Netflix put out stated or implied that it was like 50 years prior to the events of the Dark Crystal movie. Okay. And on one hand, when I read that, I was like, well, okay, I wanted to see, like, you know, 800 years ago, you know. But on the other hand, a lot can change in 50 years.
Right.
It also, I think, makes it more likely that we get to actually see this period of time where they're trying to kill all the Gelflings. Not that I want to, like, witness, like, Gelflings being murdered or anything, but I just think that's a very interesting part of the lore and gives you a window into, you know, the Skeksis' motives and you know, that's really the big struggle of the Gelflings.
Yeah.
And since the title of the show is Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance, then that, I think that makes sense, that it's approximately like 50-ish, you know, years ago.
Right.
But are there any other, like, aspects of the movie that you want to get into and talk about right now before we...
Well, I mean, like I mentioned the Star Wars thing earlier, and there were more things that reminded me of Star Wars while watching it. It's like, you know, when Kira and Jen meet and they do their mind meld thing. They call it what? Dream?
Oh, yes.
Dream fasting or dream casting?
Mm-hmm. Dream fasting. Mm-hmm.
Where they're basically sharing. Yeah, dream casting makes more sense. I wrote down dream fasting because I'm stupid. they're sharing memories of, you know, how Kira's mom, like, stuck her in the tree, and then she gets taken by the Garthen. I'm like, oh, wait, is this going to be a Luke and Leia situation where we find out, you know, their brother and sister?
That would suck for the future of the Gelfling species.
Yeah, I know, the last two. And, well, we got to do this, sis.
And oh, God.
Then they go to the
please no.
They go to the Podling Village, and they're all, you know, they're in the cantina in the Podling Village.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, man, this is just like the Ewoks.
That was like a nice little hoedown that they were having with the Podlings there. That was a good time.
Yeah, they're dancing around and drinking, and then of course they get attacked by the Garthen again, which remind me
that was another shocking moment for me as a kid, frankly, is when, like, because those Podlings are the most innocent, like, nice little cute. I mean, they look like little babies. Like,
Are they Cabbage Patch Kids or little potato people or Fraggles? What are they?
Like, oh, I was watching it with my wife, and, you know, we have a baby that's like about 2.5 months old right now. And she has those like round cheeks and, you know, big eyes.
Yeah, you have your own little Podling.
And my wife commented, she was like, oh, my God, they look like the baby, you know. And so it made it like doubly, shocking and traumatic when suddenly, you know, their party is crashed by the evil monsters and they get carted away.
And that's when you look at your wife and give her the Chamberlain.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay.
And the Garthen, for our gamers in the audience who play Fallout, you will recognize they look exactly like the Mirelurks from Fallout 4. Yeah. Aside from, like, the Mirelurks have, like, a single shell instead of a plated shell like that. Hmm. But, yeah, they look just like them. I'll send you a picture afterwards.
I wonder if they were inspired directly by that. That's cool.
Yeah, and that's one thing, too. Are they actually living... They're basically like golems, if you think about it, because at the end, they just kind of, when the crystal is purified and stuff, and it does its own little version of the snap, you just see the Garthen, they just fall apart, and they're like empty shells, you know? So
right.
I wonder, are they actually living creatures? Are they like,
they must,
you know, golem automatons?
They must have been like, yeah, magical constructs of the Skeksis. That's interesting. Yeah. I wonder if we'll get to see them in the show.
Right.
Yeah, you know, back real quick to that dream fasting that they had. I thought that was such a such an interesting thing in the movie, and I was fascinated by that as a kid. And I think, you know, with a fantasy movie like this, there's always so much exposition, like so much information that needs to be conveyed about the setting, you know, about the characters, about the rules of the setting, you know, because it's not a familiar world. And I thought one of the things that this movie is really good at is giving us that information in an interesting way that doesn't feel like a big fat info dump, you know.
Right.
And so, yeah, we get their voiceovers kind of explaining a lot. But at the same time, we're seeing all these images and flashes of things from their life. And those are like all puppets and sets and things that they constructed specifically for like a 30-second dream sequence, you know?
Right.
And God, yeah, this movie just does such a fantastic job of building this world into a believable place that we can just inhabit. So, okay. Here's another thing I wanted to make sure and mention. Back to the theme. So I think it's really interesting that when the crystal is healed at the end and you know, the world, you know, becomes whole again, that the actual name of the crystal, the whole crystal, is the Crystal of Truth. And so it's just, it's in a way, I think it's an emphasis on this message that the film has, which is like, you know, okay, you know, you can talk about good and evil and these other things as separate concepts, but in the end, they're all parts of a whole, and that's the truth. That's
right.
That's how you can build a better world, is by recognizing that and you know, acting accordingly. So
yeah.
I thought that was real interesting that it was called the Crystal of Truth. That was one detail that I had forgotten from the movie, was that they called it the Crystal of Truth. And I guess in some of the trailers for the new show, they're actually referring to it as the Crystal of Truth. So it must have been before it started getting this bad rap as the Dark Crystal,
right?
That part of it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the show. One thing I noticed in the trailers, they actually, and I was reading up on it, they mentioned the term augmented puppetry. And I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it's like they're still using the puppets.
They are. They're using exactly we've made some strides in technology and materials and things since 1982, sure. But I mean, it's still the same concept of this is a movie with really detailed puppets that are going to bring the story to life. And to me,
basically, it must be like the puppet masters are in those green man suits, you know, controlling the puppets, and then they're just totally edited out. So you have a full CGI landscape or set, and then literal puppets.
I don't know. I really wonder how much. I mean, I'm sure there are going to be some like setting details that are probably CGI, or at the very least, they're going to use some digital compositing to like put the the characters and props and things on like onto a, you know, a backdrop. But yeah, that'll be real interesting to see. Like, this is the type of show that even though it's going to be on Netflix, I'm definitely buying like the home video like disc set, like the Blu-ray set when it comes out, because I just love seeing all the special features and being able to explore all those details. So why don't we wrap up with some final thoughts on The Dark Crystal, the 1982 movie by Jim Henson. What are your final thoughts on this movie?
Yeah, like I said, watched it dozens of times as a child, and then the older I got, the longer the stretches of time in between reviewings were. But like I mentioned earlier, this is a movie that if you do remember from your childhood, and if you have children or you don't, you need to sit down and watch this one again. Watch it as an adult, watch it knowing what you know today. And you, like you mentioned, it just sucks you right back in. You didn't have a problem getting back into it. There's a lot for everyone to enjoy.
Can I interject here real quick? Because this is a thought I had before that I didn't want to forget. So when you're saying that, I think that when we're talking about comparing it to like the ways in which it appeals to both, you know, both kids and adults compared to Toy Story, it's like with The Dark Crystal, it appeals to children versus adults in a way that, like, have you ever read The Catcher in the Rye?
I have not.
So that is, I mean, you know, it's a book that's hailed as a classic and this and that and the other. And it is a really amazing novel. But the thing about that is the person who initially lent me a copy of their book, who was, like, actually my ex-girlfriend's father, but he told me that every time you read this, like if you read it, you know, now at the time I was like in college, you read it 10 years later, you read it 10 years after that, 10 years after that, every single time you're going to see something different in the story. You're going to get something different out of the story. But at the same time, it's a good story for you at whatever age you're at. And I feel like the same is true for The Dark Crystal. When you're a kid, you watch it and you get a lot out of it. When you're an adult, you watch it and you still get a lot out of it. But, you know, from your sort of more mature mindset, you know, and an emotional place that you're at as an adult, you know, maybe it in a
you
way.
You get a little more between the scenes, you know.
Well, you get a little bit more between the scenes, between the lines. You just kind of understand it at a different from a different perspective,
you can relate to it.
Maybe from a wider perspective, yeah. But at the same time, it's not like you're responding to like jokes or references that were put in there for adults. No, it's just that because you're older, you can see different aspects of the story. And I think that that's one of the really big strengths of this movie and what does make it a timeless classic. So
yeah. And it's like a crystal, you know, you look at it from a different light and see it through a different prism.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. So I did interrupt you. So what were the rest of your final comments?
Yeah, it's basically saying, check it out again, share it with your kids, especially with the new season of the show coming out. I think there's a lot more to this story that can be told. Definitely. And it'll be great to see that coming. And that'll probably be released on Netflix 2 or 3 days after this podcast is released. So check it out, folks. Yeah, I can't wait to see what's coming next.
Great. Well, since you mentioned, you know, the show coming out, we're recording this podcast on August 24th, 2019. And of course, the prequel show, Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance, is coming to Netflix on August 30th. So in like 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be doing another episode on the Dark Crystal show, probably, you know, maybe not next week, because we definitely need time to watch it and absorb it and, you know, prepare for the podcast. But, you know, maybe in like a couple weeks from now, we'll have the follow-up episode where we talk about the prequel. And in that episode, I hope to, you know, talk about some of the connections and, you know, that'll be really fun to get into. But
yeah, I want to see where Biscuit came from.
Biscuit. Yeah, Fizz gig. Anyway, so all that said, you know, my final thoughts, you know, on this review or discussion, really, of the Dark Crystal movie are, well, I think I've said it. I mean, it really, this is a movie that, despite, you know, being made like 30 some odd years ago, really has stood the test of time. I mean, you don't watch it and think to yourself, oh, well, this is obviously an 80s movie. I mean, you know, you could, you know, if you're not watching a, like a remastered version of it or something, it might look a little bit old in terms of like the film grain on it or something, but it's, or, you know, some faded colors or something, but it is not, it really does stand the test of time. It excited my imagination, you know, and even with the nostalgia aside, it really brought me back into that like childlike wonder, which is the state that,
Yeah.
I really want to be, you know, when I'm watching especially a fantasy movie, I really want it to just sweep me away and just allow me to forget about all the crappy things in my life for like an hour and a half at least. You know what I mean? And I mean, that's not the only thing I want out of a movie, but this movie definitely succeeded in doing that. I mean, even now when I'm, you know, 40 years old, it's like, you know, and I've become a much more jaded, you know, version of myself over the years. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie really brought me back to that state of childlike wonder, which I think is important, actually, that as human beings, we revisit that part of ourselves every now and then.
Yeah, never lose your childlike wonder. You gotta
hold on to that. What was it that Einstein said? He said there's this great quote from Einstein where he said something, you know, he who
something
is
about
no longer
numbers and letters.
Shush. E=mc². Yeah, that's relevant to the Dark Crystal. Yeah. No, I mean he said something like, he who is no longer able to, you know, stand wrapped, you know, in awe is already dead. And
right.
I think I'm actually paraphrasing that quote. I'm not getting it exactly right because I don't have it in front of me because it just occurred to me. But that's something that that's always kind of resonated with me and that I've always remembered, because I think that as adults, it's really easy to fall into cynicism and just anxiety and, you know, being sort of just beaten down by the difficulties and stresses of life, right? And
you get sucked into the machine.
I get sucked into the machine. That there's that wonderful Pink Floyd song, "Welcome, My Son, to the Machine." But anyway, Dark Crystal alleviated the awful parts of life for me for like good, you know, 90 minutes or however long it is. And you
have not watched it with your son, correct?
I haven't, because he's only like 2.5 or, you know, a little older than that. And so he's just not ready for it. I think he would be really scared by some of the stuff in there right now.
He's still into Baby Shark.
Oh, God. Stop. Don't put it in my head. Stop it. For those of you who don't know what Baby Shark is, for the love of all that you hold dear, do not look it up online. You will regret it instantly.
YouTube.com, search Baby Shark.
Don't do it. Don't do it. Anyway, what this all comes down to is this is still a fantastic movie. You know what? I don't really like the idea of rating these older movies necessarily, because I don't know how many people are actually listening to this spoiler-filled discussion of a 30-year-old movie and, you know, in the sense of trying to determine whether they want to watch it for this first time. But I really want to give this movie like a 10 out of 10, because it is one of the greatest fantasy movies ever made, I think. I really think it is. And if you haven't seen this movie, which I can't imagine if you've gotten this far in the podcast, do yourself a favor and go watch it. If you haven't seen it in a really long time, find a night to revisit it, especially if you're thinking about watching the new Dark Crystal show on television.
Yeah, if you haven't watched it in a long time, there's, like you said earlier, every time you watch it, you're going to get something new. There's parts of this you've never seen because you probably haven't been paying attention the whole time. And you forget some things, so it's worth checking
out
again.
There's tons of little details, yeah.
I agree with the rating old movies and stuff, but I would, just because of the nostalgia factor, and after rewatching it, it's like a whole new movie, and it's 37 years old, and I'd also give it a 10 out of 10 personally, but because there's just so much to it, and it's one of those movies that you can, as an adult, share with your kids and watch.
Right.
You know, you plant that seed in them, and that's a whole nother thing. So yeah, 10 out of 10 for me. I did, while we were talking about it, look it up on IMDb, and it is rated a 7.2 on IMDb. But even that is not bad. So if you've never seen it, this is a 7.2. Check it.
Interesting side note, because we, love this movie so much, but I remember a little bit ago when you said, at the end of it, your son was like, it was okay. And I'm actually wondering whether that's just because of his personality and how he expresses things, or do you think that because we're inundated with so many big franchises and like big scale, like, fantasy movies and things these days, is it just more that it got lost in the shuffle for him, because it wasn't this big, singular event for him, whereas when we were kids, I mean, there was hardly any good fantasy movies whatsoever. So when this comes out, it was a really big deal. I mean, how much do you think that has to do with it?
I think it has a lot to do with it. I mean, basically his entire life, I mean, he's about the same age, give or take a year or two, of the MCU, look at it from that angle. So his entire life he's grown up with. And like I mentioned when we were reviewing those summer blockbusters and stuff, seeing the MCU, on film today, for me, has brought the comics back to life in a way that nothing really did on TV or in the movies, just because the effects and the technology wasn't so advanced. But now, like when I was growing up thinking about superheroes in my mind, versus what's on the comic book page, now I go to the movies and I see in 1080p, 4K, whatever you want to call it, that fantastic world exactly the way the mind envisions it, So he's had his whole life like that. So there's a lot that he's been, experiencing, not just the MCU, but movies and entertainment overall.
So you're just saying that he's desensitized to the spectacle a little bit? Is that what you're saying?
I think possibly older movies like this, and though we did say, he was saying, how come the graphics are so good? He noticed that right off the bat. And that's I think, kind of the view children his age and kids these days look back on the movies we love growing up, and a lot of them technologically and graphically did not withstand the test of time, and they're kind of an eyesore, some of them.
Yeah.
So I think the kids kind of look back on that distant era of movies and such,
like, oh, they're corny and they look bad and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. They're crappy. And they want to see the explosions and the things flying through the air and, time travel and all that stuff.
Speaking of this, I think one of the things I noticed a lot more as an adult that I did not notice when I was a kid is that it really is it's a coming of age story too. I mean, because, Jen, the main Gelfling character is, he's basically a kid who is
Jen Skywalker.
Right. Well, he has to leave his home and go on this quest. And in the process, he basically has to become a much more mature person. And if you look at the movie as a coming of age story, it really does adhere to that model, because, when he first leaves, he's confused and excited about this journey, even though he's also grieving for his, his dead mentor. Right. So here's the thing. He's a kid who is raised. His mentor slash father slash teacher dies, right? So that's a big thing spurring, you know, him on to the next part of his journey as a person. He leaves home. And then, if you notice, before he gets to Algra and, like, the bad things start happening, he, like, walks by beautiful waterfalls and sees, like, you know, the mountains in the distance. And it's, like, this amazing, like, beautiful
world. And he's in awe of it because he's never seen it.
Yes. And so, you know, there's that. And then he encounters his first obstacles and, he, you know, at Algra and it just goes on and on from there until finally, you know, he has this this girl that he's come to love who's, you know, first is his friend, but, you know, you get the sense, at least as an adult, that, like, there could be some, like, romantic interest there. At least I was – maybe I was just projecting that onto it. But I just felt like that as the both of them were growing as characters and growing up as characters, that that would be something that – because they're supposed to now build a world together at the end, right? So
yeah,
that seemed to be the implication.
Generally, the trajectory, I feel the same, that their relationship would be going that way. They didn't really talk about romance, and there were no...
of course. You know, yeah, I'm just...
Slowly touching hands and looking each other in the eyes, but...
I'm just saying that was the implication, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the arc
they'd
definitely be going on.
So it also works as this great coming-of-age story that I think that as at least young kids... I mean, maybe you could kind of see it as like a... Like if, you know, you're like a young adult, but that's also, that's part of how the story gets into your subconscious, you know, when it's going through, you know, when it's going through these events and these pieces of the story that, I mean, they're working on your subconscious, even if you don't recognize, you know, as a kid, like, oh, this is a coming of age story. 'Cause you might not even know what that
is. I'd like to think that, any man of substance today, or man or woman, always had as a child, you know, they want to be that knight in shining armor. They want to be the one that comes and saves the day and rescues the love interest and sweeps her off her feet. You know, they just want to be that hero.
Yeah.
And I think more people need to try and get back to that.
Yeah.
Be heroes more often.
Well, on that note, I just want to wrap up by saying this is a fantastic movie in every sense of the word. You should definitely give it another go. You know, perhaps even before watching the new Netflix Dark Crystal Age of Resistance show, because I think that having watched this movie again, you know, very recently, is going to allow me to watch the show with...
Well, you get more out of it.
Yes, it's going to allow me to get some more out of the show and read it a little more deeply and kind of see, you know, these details that were in the movie and kind of, you know, compare and contrast them. So... On that note, this has been a fun little discussion of The Dark Crystal.
Yeah.
Great.
I liked it.
Yeah, great movie. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Make sure you tune in to our next episode, or maybe not the next episode, but make sure to tune into the episode where we go through and discuss the new Netflix show, the prequel to The Dark Crystal movie. Thanks, everybody, once again. This is Captain Will signing out.
Yes, Poindexters, as Captain Will said, check in with us on our next Dark Crystal show, and also check in with us on all of our episodes, every single one. You can find us at mechadragon.net. You can catch our podcast on Anchor, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, CastBox, Stitcher, the list goes on and on. And on all those sites, please give us a thumbs up, a like, 5-star ratings and reviews on whichever platform you're on. We'd really appreciate it. You can find us on Facebook as Mecha Dragon and Twitter and Instagram as Mecha Dragon Show. Shoot us an email at mechadragonshow@gmail.com with any comments, questions, corrections, or topics, and we will see you in the next episode. Peace out.
Take care, everybody.
I hate your whimper.
Our music is Overworld by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.